Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow.
Because I'm just thinking of the metaphor of the in the music video, because he's sacrificing himself for the piano.
Like, he's got to get to that gig.
Yeah.
And they're making him bring the upright piano.
And it's like raining and he's like schlepping
and
the piano.
And he's
got
to get to East
hill.
LA and he lives in Santa Monica.
And, like,
and
why
on
don't
the
they
10 freeway,
have,
that's a long way.
And like, can't they just have a keyboard at the venue?
Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Nicole, and this is Nevermind the Music.
What is your opinion, Nicole, on second drafts, first drafts and second drafts?
Tough question. I actually don't love a second draft because for me, when I'm done with something, I really do just close the mental door to that project. I don't like feedback. I don't like reviewing work. I just want to finish it and move on to the next thing. It's just my personality.
Huh.
It's unhealthy, but that's how I feel.
I feel like pretty much the same, actually. I tend to do a thing and then want to move on to the next thing, which puts me in a weird situation with music because you're kind of, you have this urge to always be revising and things like that. But I also kind of want to move on. So it's more likely that I would want to come back to something later and revise it, but then I don't want to because I'm done with it, right? So
yeah.
I tend to like write a song and then it's done instead of going back and endlessly tweaking. Maybe it's just because it would be the path to madness to try to just endlessly tweak. But
I think for me, I get so excited about the next thing that I don't want to go back and do the last thing because I already did that thing. I want to move on to do the next one.
Interesting. So you would be one of those people who we've talked about, I think, on this pod, like doesn't listen to their music ever. Like they make an album and then they never listen to it again. Whereas
I
will go listen to something. I mean, we listen to some of my music to learn from my past self and see how I've improved or whatever. You would like forget the lyrics to your own song or whatever because you haven't heard it in 20 years and you haven't gigged it or whatever.
Yeah, like I'm always surprised when artists can just go and sing, like artists that have a huge catalog of music, they can just go on stage and sing all their songs. Like, how do you remember?
I think it's because they secretly listen to their music all the time, probably. Why am I talking about second drafts? I'm talking about second drafts, listeners, because this is a second draft. This episode, we are talking about Grenade by Bruno Mars.
Catch a grenade for ya.
But we already did this, Mark.
Yeah. Why am I saying this is the second draft? What is our history with the Grenade episode of Nevermind the Music?
I think it was like the first one we did. Super clunky. We didn't have a vibe yet. We had no witty banter. We're kind of all over the place in terms of content. And this is a lesson that you hold really close to your heart in your teaching. And you felt like you need to really nail it.
The lesson, you mean, because I like talking about harmonic minor.
Yeah, love harmonic minor.
Spoilers, like spoilers. We're talking about harmonic minor. I actually hate teaching about harmonic minor, but I think this song is a wonderful example of it. So we'll get there. But yeah, we recorded this episode. Listeners, by now you've heard our Semi-Charmed Life podcast. That was our first episode that we recorded that was usable. Before that, we did this one and it was, I don't know. I was very teachy-teachy and you were kind of teachy-teachy.
Yeah.
And yeah, the vibe was off. So this is several months later, 40 episodes recorded later or something like that. We are doing it again.
We've finally arrived
at
an emotional moment to re-record.
But second drafts, I think this is one of those cases. I guess maybe a second draft. My question before was, we were thinking probably more like, oh, I wrote the essay. Am I going to revise it? What about this? I'm going to reframe the question. You didn't write the essay and then you're going to revise it. Or I didn't write the song and then I'm revising it. I wrote the song and my house caught on fire and I lost it. Or you wrote the paper and then your computer crashed and you have to redo it. What is your opinion about that second draft?
I think, you know,
not a revision, but redoing it.
I know we have an unwritten rule here on the pod not to talk about Taylor Swift, but
no, we're totally talking about Taylor Swift.
I mean, like, she was in a situation that she had to re-record. She didn't have to, but she elected to re-record her masters in this great, like, fuck the patriarchy moment. And they're better. They're better the second time because
Taylor's version.
The TVs, because they they're using her, like, one, her voice has changed and deepened as she got older, but also now she's adding this another emotional layer back from her previous history onto these songs that she recorded when she was 18, 20 years old. Now she's recording them as a 34-year-old or whatever. I'm trying not to give away that I know a lot about Taylor Swift.
No, give it away. But we're going to talk about Taylor Swift on this podcast.
I mean, it was a really powerful decision for her to go back and re-record and re-release them with different art and different content. And the fans supported her in that. And I think it can be really powerful to do stuff like that.
So now that's different in the sense that she's trying to essentially recreate the previous works, whereas this is, we are not, we're trying not to do it exactly the same, but we're taking the benefit of experience to make it better in the same way that...
I mean, she's making some artistic changes to some of the songs, for sure.
I think it varies based on which project, right? Some
for
of them
sure.
seem pretty close to the original.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, this feels like the few times in my life where I've been really stupid and didn't save recently enough on a paper and had to rewrite it or something like that, which I've learned from listeners. Control S, Command S, just save.
Well, now the computer just does it for you.
Auto saves. You gotta use those auto saves. Yeah. Got to enable it. But anyways, I find when I do it again, it's actually better often because you've done a lot of the thinking already and you got through, you solved some of the problems. And so recreating that kind of makes it like feel a little more natural, maybe even the second time. So
I agree. And we overthought it too much the first time,
I think.
So let's hit it again the second time.
This time we're fundamentally underthinking it. And
I'm
so let's see how it
very
goes.
Very much underthinking.
Okay. So where are we at with Bruno Mars? Are you a fan of Bruno Mars? Do you like...
You know what? I am a fan of Bruno Mars. I think that he has a great energy. He's got a great band he put together. I had the opportunity to see him live and he was awesome. And it was infectious. It was a great show. I like his lyrics. I like his songwriting. I'm pro. Dope. I like his vibe.
I agree. I haven't seen him live, but Bruno Mars is a songwriter's pop star. Like, I feel like the stuff he does is so smart always. And I could have an episode about all the different hits he has because each one has some really cool trick that's also nobody notices is a cool trick, right? It doesn't feel like artsy fartsy. So I've always been a fan, and obviously as a vocalist, super, super hot there. So this song we're talking about once again, Grenade. Catch a grenade for ya. Throw my hand on a blade for ya. So this is actually his second single, which for me, I think it was kind of the first one that I really noticed. Just the Way You Are was before that. I think before that also that he would have been more like well-known as a guest vocalist on other artists' music. 2010, from his debut album, Doo-Wops and Hooligans. Do you know who the Smeezingtons are? It's a professional football team, right?
No. That can't
no, that's
be right.
his former, not anymore, but his former songwriting and producing group, right? So he wrote this and produced it himself, Philip Lawrence and Ari Levine, as
can
well as others.
Say it again, the Smeezingtons?
Smeezingtons.
It's an awful name.
Smeezingtons. Maybe that's why they no longer collaborate.
Good. No thanks.
So this tune hit number one in 2011. Mm-hmm. His third number one. Okay, so yeah, Nothing on You was an example of him guesting on someone else's track. But not his last number one, obviously. So one thing that's so cool about this song, and that's kind of what launches me into wanting to use it as an episode, is it's very dark.
Yeah.
There's like an unrequited love to it. There's this martyr complex, I feel like, happening. He's lifting a piano across Los Angeles, like really... full of angst.
In the music video.
This is not probably as he was recording the song in the studio, but in the music video, he's dragging a piano and he dies at the end of the video, I think.
It's implied that the piano gets hit by the train.
That's right.
Yeah.
The poor piano. I mean, by the way, folks, you can't give away a piano. I don't feel any sympathy for an upright piano. They're so heavy. No one wants them anymore. Everybody's got these digitals now, including myself. Yeah. So it also has this really hypnotic repeating riff that's really catchy. That's probably the first thing I noticed years ago when I first heard this tune.
Easy come, easy go. That's just how you live. Oh, take it all, but you never give. Should've known.
Yeah, so it just automatically starts super dark to me and hypnotic. And when the beat comes in, it's super heavy.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking of the song. You know, we were talking about the music video and... I've always assumed this song is about another human, but maybe this song is about music in general.
Like he would do anything for the art,
sort
of, including, because I think this isn't I would do anything for you in a sweet way. It's I would do anything for you, and it's toxic is what this song feels like. And that would be the like servitude and, you know, almost like ruining your life for the sake of making music.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because I'm just thinking of the metaphor of the music video, because he's sacrificing himself for the piano.
Like he's got to get to that gig.
Yeah.
And they're making him bring the upright piano.
And it's like raining and he's like schlepping
the
piano up the hill.
And he's got to get to East L.A. and he lives in Santa Monica.
And, like,
and
why
on
don't
the 10
they just
freeway,
have,
that's a long way.
And like, can't they just have a keyboard at the venue? Like,
right.
Why is he
that's
bringing it? So I just
willing
kinda,
to die for it, right?
Yeah. And I've always thought of the song as like we equate love as love for another human. And that's like the low hanging fruit here, to think of that level of codependency. But maybe it's more the servitude of the music and the servitude of the art that he's making sacrifices to promote the art, even when it's toxic for him, which is a whole different angle of the song that I just thought of.
This is interesting. And can we keep it in mind as we keep talking? Because I think we come back to that, because I think you're probably gonna have things to say about the relationship side also. But
for sure,
maybe it all lines up. And you said this word codependency. Let's come back to that.
Yeah,
also,
we will.
Because I haven't thought about that in this song, but it feels like I said toxic, and I think codependent maybe a better way even to say it. So it's got this hypnotic piano part. This song, I said, feels sort of dark. What it is very much minor, right? Minor key. We've talked about minor keys before on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of shorthand for sad, though it doesn't have to mean sad, but this song is in the key of D minor. This is what a D minor scale sounds like, which, listeners, means just a collection of notes that make up the key of D minor.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's a D minor scale. That's the source of most of the notes in this song. And it's not unique. You're going to find minor keys in tons of pop music. But the way it's used in this song is like more minory. How's that for a music theory turn? It's more minorific. Okay, so let's listen to the way this song starts and compare that against what most other pop songs will do. So we heard this again. This is the beginning of the song, which is also the first verse.
Easy come, easy go. That's just how you live. Oh, take, take, take it all, but you never give. Should've known.
It's kind of sad, but also sort of not chill, but it's more somber. It's not like tear jerking. It's sort of.
It has like a quiet acceptance to it.
That's right. I like that. Yeah.
It just resolved. Like, this is just what it is.
And he's got this really angsty voice that has a resignation, but also a stress to it. But the piano in the back is giving us this sort of contemplative sounding minor. It's not too heavy.
Yeah, there's like a rumination there.
So we're using notes from a version of D minor that we would call D natural minor.
Cool.
If you had to guess what that meant, so what do you think it means to say that this is in D natural minor? It
means that there's no flats or no sharps.
No flats or no sharps. That's a good guess. It would use only naturals, right?
Yeah.
Natural notes means the white keys. That's actually not what it means, but that would be logical, right?
It's
but
ridiculous.
Because it's logical, we can't use that name,
right?
That's the rule in music theory.
Great.
So natural minor, in this case, a natural minor scale does have a flat. It has one flat, B flat. But
B flat is A sharp.
A sharp.
Yes.
Bingo. 40 episodes in or whatever it is. Good job. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it does have some flats, but it's natural because it comes from major scales. It grows out of major in a way that we don't need to talk about right now. You shift a major scale and you get there automatically. There isn't any weird fancy alteration. It's natural because it grows on trees, essentially, right? It's organic. Here's what that scale sounds like. Again, the scale just gives us the notes he's gonna use. Yeah, so this is a kind of minor that you're gonna find in a lot of pop music. It's gentle minor, I would say, is another way you could think of it. So from the same year, we haven't talked about Kesha really in this podcast.
I love Kesha.
But you're a fan. Yeah, I think that much I knew. But this is another song that was on the top 10 that same year. Kesha's We Are Who We Are uses the same kind of minor.
Actually, when I hear that, I realize I don't like Kesha that much, her music, but I just like her as a human. But that's
okay.
A different conversation.
Like her whole vibe.
And she's got a great redemption song that she wrote that's really lovely, but that's a different conversation.
I think she also has different chapters in her career stylistically, too.
Yeah.
So this song feels a little more happy than Grenade, which is kind of strange, considering it was written in response to the high rate of teen suicide in the LGBTQ community.
Yikes.
But I think they're, you know, the We Are Who We Are kind of has a hopeful message, or at least has a positive spin. But this natural minor key, so to speak, though that's not technically the what we should say, but using the natural minor notes gives you the flexibility to make things on the lighter side without necessarily feeling like a funeral march or whatever, like some minor key stuff can go. So what makes this different in Grenade is with what he does later. In order to show you how heavy things get in this song, let's go to the opposite end. I'm going to play you another Bruno tune,
okay.
One that's in major. And to me, this is just so major. This is from the same record, Lazy Song.
Today I don't feel like doing anything. I just wanna lay in my bed. Don't feel
so major. That's
super
a great
happy
song.
Right? Also,
it's kind of about depression, but like that's
is
fine.
It? I was gonna say, so like, is there anything better than just laying around all day? I don't know. That actually sounds if you know what my personality is like, if you heard that I was just laying around all day,
I'd be worried.
You would not be happy for me. You'd be like, something's wrong with Mark.
If you heard I was laying around all day, you'd be like, oh, that makes sense.
It's a Tuesday. Yeah.
It's a Tuesday.
She doesn't teach on Tuesday. Yeah. No, but I think this is intended to be a good thing. Do you think it's a dark?
I think it depends on what lens you're looking at it through.
Sure.
I am a big fan of being unapologetically lazy. And I think it's very healthy to give yourself days that you do nothing and don't make yourself feel guilty about. There's a phrase in social science called the tyranny of the shoulds.
Mm.
Like, I should be cooking dinner. I should be cleaning my house. I should be folding laundry. I should be prepping. I should be whatever. And that is maladaptive and bad for us because it feels like everything feels like a chore then. And that's not a good headspace to be in. So I like this song because it kind of turns that idea around, saying it's okay to do nothing. And I think that as a culture, like, we need to get better at that. But also, you know, we know that
you got to change the diapers and stuff like that.
Well,
too.
And like, it's to a point, like if you're a single guy like Bruno Mars, right, and you don't have to do anything but smoke blunts and drink champagne all day, like lay in bed, like go for it. Right. But when it starts negatively affecting your life, if you're laying around in bed and your kid's covered in its own shit, eating popsicles 24/7.
And sometimes
there's
a podcast that's not going to record itself, right? You got to get out of bed at least.
Sometimes you can't bring the microphone to your bed, I guess.
Yeah, you got to go down to the basement at the very least. So this song is super unapologetically major. We could talk about whether it's actually sort of dark subtext. And if so, I think that just highlights the point, right? Because the music is trying to sound super happy.
Yeah.
And if it is actually dark, well, that just amplifies that irony, I think.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
And if we listen to the pre-chorus of this song, which builds us up to that catchy chorus, I want you to listen to this moment of tension at the end that really defines the major key as a concept. Listen here.
Oh, yes, I said it. I said it. I said it because I can. Today I don't feel like...
Wow, that's such a 90s DJ scratch there.
I love it.
What are we listening to, Sugar Ray?
Like, I love it. Oh, Sugar Ray.
So listen again. And I want you to listen to the oohs. And the last ooh, the highest ooh, is playing this really powerfully, beautifully tense note. It's the seventh note in the scale. And that note we call the leading tone. It really wants to go up to start again. Listen again. Just feel how it's not tense like in a scary way, but tense in a way that leads us along. That's why we call it the leading tone.
Oh, yes.
Hear it?
Yeah.
Ooh, ooh. It wants to go up to the high note.
But it doesn't.
It sort of does because the chord resolves
sure,
it, right?
Sure.
The oohs don't. And that's actually interesting because if the oohs did go up, it would feel even more satisfying in that moment. and they've held us off. But we have this thing called the leading tone, which is just so close to the home note, which in the case of Grenade is D. And so what that goes along with is this chord. There's a chord that's a tense chord called 5 going to 1. We've talked about that already several times in this podcast. Hear that resolve?
Yes.
It kind of lands there. Now, when we play that as a scale, it sounds like this. If we play that back in the key of Grenade, but as major, hear how satisfying and ta-da that sounds at the end?
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't get that here.
Easy come, easy go. That's just how you live. Oh, take, take, take it all, but you never give. Should've known.
It doesn't have the leading tone. Yeah. The note at the end of the D minor scale is too far away. But then listen to what happens next. Something changes.
Should've known you was trouble from the first kiss. Had your eyes wide open. Why were they open?
Something shifts.
Something shifts.
Yeah.
What's happening is we're turning on the leading tone. We're turning on that. Remember, there's a woo there, but in the lazy song, there's that high ooh that's got our tense note.
Yeah.
They add it.
Yeah.
We're in the key of D. We had a C and they turn into a C sharp, which is as close as you get to D. We've taken natural minor and we've added that tense, beautiful note from major, right? And so there's suddenly tension as an out of key chord. This is no longer natural minor. We go from this sound, D to A minor, to this sound, D to A major. And it's way more tense. It's pointing us back. And it happens at the end of the phrase, right? To point us back and kind of make that moment more tense, to me at least.
Should've known you was trouble from the first kiss. Had your eyes wide open. Why were they open?
And it makes that arrival after the woo so much more satisfying.
Yeah.
This is called harmonic minor. Harmonic minor. It's not a key, it's a scale. A harmonic minor scale is an altered version. It's natural minor, but they raise the last note before D. Listen. And it makes things feel tense.
Kind of like a haunted church.
Haunted church. That's it. So it churches. That's interesting.
I'm getting a haunted church vibe.
I think we'll leave that there because I don't know. Have I been in a haunted church? Let's see. So it's called harmonic minor because harmony means chord, right? So this is a scale you use to build chords to make things more tense. We start with our boring minor scale. And then we have our major scale with this nice high note at the end, the seventh note. And then we mix them to get this. And what we see in this song is at the end of each section, turning on the harmonic minor. It's not all the time. It's only when he wants a tense moment. Here's the pre-chorus of the tune.
Gave you all I had and you tossed it in the trash. You tossed it in the trash. You did. To give me all your love is all I ever ask. Cause what you don't understand is I catch a grenade.
So right where he said, what you don't understand, listen again.
Give me all your love, it's all I ever ask, cause what you don't understand is I catch a grenade.
He saves it for the moment to make us want that boom of the chorus. I said that the Kesha tune stayed in natural minor, didn't turn this on, but it's pretty common for pop songs to do this similar thing where they use both and they turn on harmonic. Just a few examples. And then I really want to hear your take on this kind of thing and how it relates to this song. So one example, this is Adele's tune, Rolling in the Deep, also from 2010. You're going to hear the chord change from natural minor version to its harmonic minor version at the end of the phrase. What you're going to hear here is when she says the words, you can't help feeling, the chord is going to shift. And what that is harmonic minor turning on and becoming more intense, leading us, of course, to the big loud chorus.
It's the year of the natural minor.
Year of the natural minor. Okay, let's do an older one.
Okay.
1982, Maneater, Hall & Oates. This one doesn't
so
have
good.
This shift.
I mean, so you're hitting a lot of great notes in 1982. Yeah,
that's right. 1982.
Hall & Oates.
Super good.
Great.
Hall & Oates. This song doesn't turn it on. It's kind of more always on. Mm. This is Maneater. Ends on a nice juicy five chord with harmonic minor engaged.
You know, this song could be a real sister song to Grenade. Like, this could be describing, if we're going under the motif that this is a romantic codependency, that Maneater's describing the girl, and then Bruno Mars is acting the male part
so,
of it.
So, okay, we got to come back to that, but I just have to say, the funny thing about that, as far as I know, you know how we were saying, oh, this is a love song, but it might actually, well, it's euphemistically talking about, you know, unrequited love or something, but it might actually be about music industry.
Maybe.
That is sort of like happening in Maneater is, it's like a double layer metaphor, like a level two metaphor. It's talking about what a Maneater, a shark or a lion or something that's like a, what is it? They're talking about a specific animal in that all the time. Like only comes out at night. It's like a tiger or something like
cougar?
That, right? Maybe a cougar, yeah. Although, was that term in popular parlance?
No, but like maybe this is part of it.
Maybe this is part of
how it happened.
So, oh, they're talking about a violent animal. No, they're actually talking about a woman. No, they're actually talking about, I think, New York City.
What?
That the city will, like, I think it's New York City.
Will,
one
like,
of those
eat you
cities.
Alive. It's a Maneater.
It'll eat you up. Slash maybe the music industry in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, totally parallel. One more example, and then I'm popping it to you for a while.
I'm
Alicia
ready.
Keys, Fallen, 2001, not the year of harmonic minor.
But
she repeats, just like Bruno, uses the natural version a few times of the chord. She then turns it on at the end of the phrase in the same way as all of these other tunes, turns on the harmonic minor to give us a nice, bright major five chord, which is tense.
That song's great. It's in 6/8 time signature, right?
That song.
1, 2, 3.
I would
four,
say
five,
six,
six
or 12. That sounds like 6/8. I think you are very, very correct.
What's
there. A lot of times,
happening?
The sort of like R&B jam will be more in 12/8 because of the way it's grouped. But I feel like that's 6/8.
That's 6/8,
listeners,
man.
Let's talk about compound meter in another day.
I love a compound meter.
So
don't you?
I love compound meter, but like I actually. As much as I like the song, I sort of hate teaching harmonic minor. I also hate teaching compound meter. So let's come back to that another time. I have to have more coffee or less coffee to talk about compound meter. But yeah, good ear. I'm pretty sure 6/8 is right.
Oh, so, man. Okay. So I'm like pretty much a doctor of music.
I mean, you've heard me talk about music for like
I know
many
enough about music
is,
that I
hours?
Could like impress someone that is in
right?
music.
Impress your friends. Slash scare them away.
I don't, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So there's even a few more moments in this song that I want to draw our attention to that prove this point, but I want to hear what you think because I feel like the way that this song just feels so gut-wrenching and heavy is all tied up in these moments.
Yes.
Talk to me.
And like, so I think of this song, the low-hanging fruit of this song is to talk about codependency, right? So codependency is when another human is overly emotionally involved with another human or an animal, maybe. Some people are codependent towards items. Like you'll hear a lot, Gen Z will say, oh, this is my like emotional support water bottle or my emotional support blanket or something.
Gen Z, you mean the Zoomers?
The Zoomers.
The term that you're
sure.
contesting here?
Yes,
so
the Zoomers.
Can I have a quick question about
yes,
that before you
okay.
go on? Codependency, does it imply that it's reciprocal? Like if we have a codependent podcast host relationship and it's going one way and the other person is not engaging, is that still codependency?
Yeah, it's still codependency.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Because you as an individual are codependent and you can be codependent towards an animal, towards a water bottle, which is something to
talk
about.
How is that different from just a dependency? Then?
Well, that's what the thing is, right? You had said earlier that you said that codependency reads for you as a toxic trait. Right, it would be bad to be codependent. Do you stand by that statement?
Now I want to retract that statement and put my tail between my legs. I think if somebody were to say they had a codependent whatever, my assumption would be that is a negative thing they're pointing out. Yeah.
I agree with you to an extent, but I want to challenge that, right? Think about, like, for me, I'm baseline like an anxious person, right? The only person I immediately feel less anxious around is my husband, right? He's my, like, I hate to say safe space, you're not bringing that back up, but I feel like when I'm with him, I'm not anxious. If I'm in an anxious moment and he holds my hand, I can feel my blood pressure regulate. I can feel my body calm and my mind calm down. That's codependency, right? But I am codependent on him in that moment. I'm not okay unless he's with me.
So codependency means essentially you're not okay without that thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And that can be healthy. A lot of people have very healthy codependent relationships. You and your spouse have a codependent relationship. It's not unhealthy. You rely on each other. And that's lovely. It's lovely to have that support. But what we need to talk about is maladaptive codependency. Do you know what the word maladaptive means? I've been using it quite a bit.
It means bad, but bad in the sense that it causes you to not be able to function properly, like in a social context or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, a lot of times when we codify maladaptive behavior, we'll say it has to negatively affect your life in multiple domains, right? So I'm nerding out for a second about this, but it has to negatively affect you at school, at work, and at home, for example.
Sure.
So bad codependency is when you're not living your life because you're at the whim of another person, or you can't make a decision without that person becoming involved in the decision making. So in this Bruno Mars song, he's talking about, I'll catch a grenade for you, but you don't give that back. You wouldn't do that for me. That would be like a maladaptive codependency for sure, because he'd put it all on the line for this love interest, this friend, this piano, right, the music industry, whatever, but it's not giving anything back.
That's got to be a key part of it, right? Like the reason that your codependent relationship with your husband is not maladaptive is presumably because he's consenting to that.
Presumably.
He's okay holding your hand on a stressful day or whatever.
Sure.
And to some extent, to the extent that men are allowed to like be as emotional, he may even rely on you in the same way, right? So that's got to be, in this case, clearly the point of this song's angst is that it's not returned,
it's
right?
It's not returned,
Is
yes.
that the main reason this is maladaptive, or is it just the nature of it? It's so violent, the imagery that he's associating with this love,
true.
Right?
Yeah, he's in like a real rumination moment about why isn't this love returned? Like, what is it about you or me or the industry that am I not good enough to get the love in return? Am I not giving enough of myself to get it back in return? So there's a lot of introspection with Bruno Mars. He's becoming like self-actualized, that a lot of people in codependent relationships don't have the hindsight to say, hey, this is a bad relationship. I'm in a bad spot right now. I'm too wrapped up in this other human. They don't see it. Their friends see it. Their family sees it, but they can't. They're like blinded by the love, quote unquote. But Bruno Mars here is starting to turn on to the idea that, hey, maybe this isn't okay. Like, maybe this isn't healthy. Why do I keep putting myself in this position that there's nothing coming back to me? Which I think is a really interesting time and moment for human growth in an individual, when you start realizing, hey, something's not right here. Like, why am I dragging this piano across the city in the rain? For what? Like, what are you ever doing for me? So I'm really eager as a psychologist to see what happens next for him. I mean, if you watch the video, it doesn't end great.
Well, next is Treasure.
Yeah.
Right, which is on the next album, that's a happy song,
yeah.
I think. Locked Out of Heaven, though. You make me feel like I've been locked out of heaven for too long. For too long. Maybe sort of not as happy. I don't know, but he eventually gets to finesse in 24 Karat Magic, though, so.
Yeah, and he sees his progression as an artist into now present day Bruno Mars it's still very poppy, but it's completely his own. Like, he's not being led by the industry as much. He's kind of making his own path.
I feel like he's leading the industry. Yeah. Like, oh, let's make New Jack Swing a thing. Let's do Finesse or whatever.
It's great. And it has an audience for sure. So maybe, you know, I'm going back to this new idea I just had 20 minutes ago, that this song isn't about romantic love. It's about love of creativity and passion towards creative endeavors that, like, maybe at times feel like they're not serving you, but at the end it leads to something better. Which, to go back to your point about, like, second drafts, right? That's part of this too, that the more you kind of push through and the more you work, the better things are in the end, even if in the moment it feels kind of maladaptive.
Right. And in the end, the song does not end with a positive affirmation of it, right? It ends on a bad note. Like, I don't think the song resolves in the same, quite the same way as the video. The video obviously ends on a bad note. But I mentioned the violence, like he'll catch a grenade. Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess that's sacrifice yourself to save someone's life. Okay, sure. I guess that's noble on some level, even if it's a little like chivalrous in a way that's maybe kind of toxic or whatever. He would throw myself in front of a train or something, he says, which is like, okay, maybe to save that, put a bullet through my brain. Well, what good does that do, dude? Like, he's not even talking at a certain point. And maybe if this is connecting to the music industry thing, like, that's not even doing something for the art. That's just a self-destructive behavior, just to make a point or something.
Yeah. So, and we see that a lot in a lot of clinical presentations, like self-destructive behavior just to make a point. Like, it's actually a notable characteristic for many mental health conditions, that I'll attempt to sacrifice my own life just to prove you wrong, just to show you how sick I really am. And it's not necessarily always like ends personal suffering. It's to like get at someone.
Or I think young people, like kids and stuff, acting out in the same way, right?
Sure.
Did you ever want to like teach your parents a lesson when you were kids by being bad? Like, definitely that's an urge that I feel like, it'll show them if I run away or whatever. Like, that's got to be a common.
No, I never had that urge. Did you have the urge to do stuff like that? To run away from home?
Oh, I definitely. But it was all for, was all an act.
Like I joined the barbershop quartet. Circus.
No,
I
was before that was before my awakening to barbershop. No, but like the whole like I got in a bad fight with my parents or whatever, I'm gonna storm off at front and say I'm running away. I wasn't gonna run away, but there was because you wanted like to make a show. And that's what this song sort of is, right? It's a show of these gestures of how much he loves this person or this industry, but maybe those things are just performative anyways, right? I don't know.
A lot of times they are. Like in a codependent toxic relationship, a lot of it is very performative to get a stir out of the other person, to kind of drum up some interest from the other person. Yeah, that's a not healthy form of codependency. But I'll argue all this to say codependency is not always a bad thing. There are healthy and unhealthy versions of it. And it's a spectrum. To some point, aren't we all codependent on each other as humans? Like you could not exist on an island by yourself.
Sure.
Like you need others.
Just not maladaptively codependent, right?
Sure.
Is the ideal.
Yeah.
And now that I'm thinking of, I could have mentioned this earlier, but that bullet through my brain.
Yeah.
That's an extremely dark, extremely toxic, crazy moment. How does that fit in with what I was saying musically? Well, if we listen to the main part of the hook. Catch a grenade for ya. Throw my hand on a blade for ya. That's all just natural minor. Doesn't use our fancy raised note in harmonic minor. But when we listen to the end, when he says the words, bullet straight through my brain, that's where we get it. Oh, I would go through all this pain. Take a bullet straight through my brain. Yes, I would die for you, baby. But you won't do the same. We get it on the bullet line, and then I would die for you, baby, but you won't do the same.
I know, it's just like so awful, right? I would die for you, but you won't do the same. Like, is that the bar, right?
Yeah.
Of like love, that we need this level of self-sacrifice? It's
so I feel so sad. I feel like that while we can say, I think the way this is framed, we can say that this is unhealthy. I feel like there's also, it's like kind of taught to us and romanticized on some level. I remember, think like early crush, the age where you have an early crush. So like fifth grade or whatever, mm-hmm. right? I was not one of those people who had a girlfriend when I was in first grade. I was, you know, some people have that, but the first glimmers of a real adolescent mm-hmm. crush, like fifth grade or sixth grade, I used to like fantasize about like, what if that girl got bullied and I would stick up to her, like save her, like this romanticized of like, I'm going to sacrifice myself as a desperate show of my dedication slash my awesomeness. It's like, I kind of feel like as much as people would hear Bruno here and go, that's not healthy. Mm-hmm. We're also kind of like programmed to want to go there.
I think that in the demographic and the cohort you grew up in, you were programmed to feel like in order to show love to a female, I have to protect her.
Like die in war.
And like, I'll say it's my hope that that motif is changing for like our kids and their generation. Cause I know my 10-year-old daughter will say explicitly, like, don't rescue me. Like, I don't need a prince to come save me. And that's seems as a woman, I think that that's great. Like, you don't. But there is this motif of the people that you love. It's your job to protect them. And I think that that's healthy, right? Sure. And that makes sense.
Of course. But that being romanticized, right?
Right.
Or like volunteer fire departments who are like a bunch of civilians and just hoping their neighbor's house burns down so they get to get out the hose and save it. Like, I don't know how cool that is.
Like Dwight Schrute when he finds the joint in the parking lot and he like interviews everybody.
I haven't seen that episode in a long time, but he gets to finally exercise his power,
yes.
right?
People love power. So they just love power.
And this feels like there's power in the relationship that mm-hmm. maybe, yeah, anyways, even though he's clearly the bottom rung in the relationship in terms of what the reality is, right? If it's completely unrequited.
But we don't know, though. We don't know the other person's perspective.
That's
maybe
true.
She's like, oh, I have this great guy and he's really nice to me. And she's not in his head with all these like crazy thoughts and he's not sharing them with her. Like, we don't know.
It's interestingly not present in the song.
Yeah.
I was just struck by something. I'm talking about this song with no, like, we're ascribing all this. So this is kind of toxic. This is gross. But I don't have any sense that this is Bruno Mars, that I'm like demonizing Bruno Mars. So I hope it doesn't sound like I am, listeners. And Bruno, if you're listening, thanks for listening. First of all, hit us up.
Yeah. Can you like
nevermusicpod@gmail.com?
Share our stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. But I don't have any, this doesn't feel like, you know how like a Taylor Swift song, you're like, oh, that's a real guy she's talking about. That feels real. This feels like, I'm sure he can relate to desperation and bad love, but I don't, this doesn't translate into, oh, Bruno Mars is toxic, man.
I mean, did he even write the song?
He co-wrote the song.
Okay.
The Smeezingtons.
The Smeezingtons.
The Smeezingtons wrote the song. So, but it isn't, there's an interesting, because of the lack of specificity about details, I'm not, oh, wow, there's some lady he was into when he was in his 20s that really ruined him.
And we don't really think of Bruno Mars as autobiographical in the same way we think of Taylor Swift.
Right.
Like every song you think like, okay, this is part of her lore somewhere, right?
That's right, yeah.
And we don't really feel like that for Bruno Mars.
Sure.
And we don't know the other side of the story. Maybe the person that he's with, that this is a nod to a romantic relationship, is super into it. Maybe this person loves the fact that this guy is schlepping this piano around for her and like she has him under her thumb. Like some people like,
or
for
maybe
some people that
she
relationship
has,
works.
Or maybe she has manipulated the situation to put him in this sense of disadvantaged place too, right?
Sure.
We don't know. It could
we
be good,
know.
It could be bad. Yeah.
Right. Maybe he's financially codependent on her. So he feels like he has to sacrifice emotionally for her so he can get his bag.
Yeah.
Question I think of for this is when I think of Bruno Mars dragging the piano, I think of what am I dragging around that isn't healthy for me, or habits that I have, or people in my life that like aren't serving me, and how can I let them go and let them go with love?
Are you gonna
let's start
break up with one
them.
Of your friends today on this pod?
Well, that's an interesting question too. Have you ever had to break up with a friend because they weren't a good friend to you? I've had, and it's a tricky thing to navigate.
I think those situations have usually sort of just also organically disappeared because like someone moves that away or whatever, moves away or something like that. So I don't think I've ever really had to separate. You've had to actually
like sit down over coffee and decide that we're not gonna do it anymore.
Wow.
It wasn't my idea.
Oh wait,
I think maybe
they
I was
broke
broken
up,
with,
up
with and then I got, I don't know, maybe it wasn't working.
Wow. Okay, yeah, I think that's
and they
good.
Weren't taking the hint and we just kind of tried to keep it going and it just wasn't working.
I think there's also something. So like you live where you grew up.
Not anymore, but I used to. Yeah.
No, but you live like
in the region.
In the region. Mm-hmm. So you might have a friendship that hasn't worked out that you kind of have to, you can't completely ignore it. You have to like decide this is a bad idea. Whereas there could be a friend I had in high school or college or whatever that now lives 3,000 miles away that the easiest solution is just not call them and not look them up when I'm in town, right? Yeah. It's easier for me to let a relationship naturally fizzle out or whatever because I've moved around so much, whereas you've moved around a lot less, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is like, he's dragging this piano across town. We could talk obviously about which member of the band it would be the worst to be. Like schlepping drums around, schlepping a bass around is a lot harder than dragging a violin across town or something like that.
Yeah. But
the piano, I feel like, is the one associated with death, right? Like there's jokes about pianos falling on your head. He dies in this music video dragging it around. Is there another instrument that...
An instrument of murder.
Well, okay. Yes. Yes. True. But how about a literal musical instrument
you
of murder?
You could like put poison inside someone's bagpipe, right? So it would like...
So it would like blow... I don't think you inhale.
I don't know.
You sort of circularly breathe in the back, but you don't inhale the inside.
Didgeridoo.
Didgeridoo? You're breathing in, I think, through your nose for a didge. For a didgeridoo.
For didge. Listen to
this
you
guy. Don't like, you don't like my abbreviations. Like, what did I say the other day? Keeps? He plays the keeps. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because Bruno Mars doesn't even read as a keyboardist to me. He doesn't even play the keys. He plays guitar mostly. So why is he, why is he carrying the piano?
He plays, like, When I Was Your Man, that video, he's playing the piano on it. I think he plays...
When I Was Your Man, like, maybe that this is what he's talking about.
Oh, like that's the retrospective look at this song. That would be the sad retrospective look on this song. You're right. Well, it's like, which one, even in pop culture, because you're saying like Poison bagpipes or whatever, but... I feel like guitar string strangling somebody, that could be a thing like that. I feel like I've seen that before. No. Maybe I'm just a guitarist and people talk about that.
Oh, like in like a murder mystery, like you take
that's
the,
right.
not like it
like
snaps
Clue.
Off and wrap lassos around your neck
no,
and then
though,
you just
honestly,
die, like
dude,
spontaneous.
Guitar strings are so sharp. If you cut your guitar players, those of you who I see with the strings uncut, just flapping around, wait till you stick one of those things in your thumb and you get tetanus or something. They are so sharp. Cut your strings down. No, I meant like, what is that rope thing that like an assassin would use behind you and choke you?
Like
you could use a guitar string to do that.
Oh, like a knife. Yeah, you could.
I don't know what's that called.
I think it's just a rope, dude.
Just a rope. No, I think it's probably the low string on a guitar or a bass string.
Or like a nylon string.
You said poison. What's the... I think a violin bow. You could skewer somebody with one
if you
sharpened it. Maybe it's wooden, though. It might break.
Like probably a tuba or something. Like a timpani drum you could get trapped inside.
Ooh.
You could like trap a kid inside a timpani and like tighten the head, right? And suffocate them. This is getting this is a weird conversation.
This is weird. Yeah, it is weird.
I think piano is like definitely the most iconic murderous instrument.
Oh my gosh. I've been literally electrocuted by a microphone.
Oh,
so
microphone.
I sing and I play the guitar. The guitar has power going through it. The microphone has, I have completed the circuit, so to speak, a few times when there's bad electrical. And I don't know, is that me completing the circuit or breaking it? I don't know what
you
it is.
You complete the circuit if it goes through you.
Because I have been totally electrocuted in rehearsals, not in performances. Not to the point that I'm dead, but it doesn't feel good. And it messes with your head because every time I get close to that mic, I'm waiting for it to happen again.
Okay.
And I think that could happen. Listeners, look it up. Let us know. Has anybody died by being electrocuted from holding a guitar while singing? Because that, I know... The talk box, the thing you stick in your mouth and go, wah, wah, wah.
Oh my gosh, that's probably
dangerous.
You
can get shocked by those too. Yeah.
Wah, wah, indeed.
Never Mind the Music is hosted by me, Mark Papany, and Nicole Vatcher. I also produce the podcast. Please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and a review.
And let us know what you think on social media. We're Never Music Pod on all major platforms. You can also send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com. And every so often, we'll do a mailbag episode where we answer your burning questions.
Thanks for listening.
Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear three full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.